Well, welcome from my side as well, and many thanks to Professor Nunning for kind of laying the foundation for my part of the lecture. And I have to admit that I feel a bit like a band in a festival that's supposed to play after the main act, and after the headliner has already left the stage with the crowd enthusiastic. And now this has to be, unfortunately, my part, but I will try give my best to keep up the tension and keep it as interesting as possible for you. So now, what do I present you with? In what follows, I would like to attempt to outline a concrete example of how literary studies as life science could look like. And since some of the conceptual assumptions or ideas that Ansgar Nunning has presented you with in his part of the lecture are so of crucial importance for the remainder of the lecture, that I should briefly reiterate them. What are they? Firstly, as Ansgar Nunning has already said, literature should be regarded as a cognitive instrument or force which is itself not neutral or transparent, but already informed by certain worldviews and ideologies, and at the same time, in turn, it can affect extra-literary reality. Secondly, form, and that's a part of the quotation that you have already seen, form is apprehended as content. Literary forms become inseparable from the content of literature in many respects. Thirdly, narrative forms are seen as culturally and socially constructed, that is, their analysis can also tell us something about the society or culture they were produced in. And finally, literature often focuses on repressed areas and dimensions of the real world. One might call this the collective unconscious. Literature often represents values and knowledge which deviate quite remarkably from those that are widely accepted in a given society. Now, the basic idea underlying my approach is that the life knowledge of literature is crucially connected, very much in the sense of what has been said, to what in literary studies we call genre. And although you probably already had enough of theory for today, it is necessary for me to very briefly again elaborate on the significance of genre with regards to our topic today, the knowledge of literature, before I then turn to my exemplary case study. Despite the term genre in German Gattung, which is derived from its biological use, where genus refers to the hierarchical order of distinguishable species of animals and plants, genres in literary contexts are not given or natural entities. They do not resemble clear-cut and stable classifications. Quite to the contrary, in fact, current genre theory assumes that genres are of little value in classification, which is, of course, their main function in biology, but fulfill important functions as communication systems for the use of writers and writing and readers and critics in reading and interpreting. What does that mean? Writers and readers communicate in terms of genres. Both have a more or less clear conception of what a novel or a short story usually look like, and both make use of this knowledge. However, these genres are rather arbitrary and flexible concepts that can, and in fact do, change quite remarkably over time. A typical English or American novel from the 19th century differs in many respects from what could be regarded as a typical contemporary novel, if such a thing exists at all, one might add. But even on a synchronic level, texts regarded as belonging to one common genre often vary so significantly that it is extremely difficult to pin down a definition of that particular genre. What we are faced with is such a variety that it seems to mock all our efforts at classification. What we have here then looks like a downright paradox. Genres, understood as sets of conventions, do exist somewhere out there and perform their function of regulating literary communication, even though it is highly problematic to objectively identify their characteristic features. Using the example of the short story, this means that our recognition of a text, and I'm quoting here from Sabine Kirch-Feusner, who writes on the short story, our recognition of a text as short story will guide our reading and our strategies in making sense of what we read, end of quote. Or to use the other quote that you also find on the slide by Elisabeth Wesseling, for the reader, genres constitute sets of expectations which steer the reading process. Generic repertoires might be regarded as bodies of shared knowledge which have been inferred from perceived regularities in individual literary texts. So you see the relationship between individual texts and then the knowledge that is kind of created out of these texts. As sets of norms which both readers and writers are aware of, genres fulfill an important role in the process of literary communication, unquote. So this would be like the first connection between knowledge and literature. You need some knowledge of literary genres, and this knowledge is acquired usually in a quite natural and unconscious way. But whereas genres, via this shared knowledge of generic conventions and norms, thus fulfill important functions in literary communication, they are also important with regards to knowledge in another way. We can assume that knowledge as such, that is, knowledge in a pure and unmediated form, cannot be communicated. Or one might even go so far as to say that it doesn't even exist. Even in the natural sciences, with their claim of objectivity, certain formats are used to constitute and communicate knowledge. To give you one example and a very illuminating and illustrative case in point would be Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species. Over years and decades, Darwin had observed natural objects and phenomena and recorded them in different formats. Only after careful and repeated examination and interpretation, he was able to formulate one long argument based on his manifold and diverse observations and the conclusions that he had drawn from these. Hence, his theory of evolution becomes knowledge only through its form, which integrates graphic elements and textual statements into one systematic argument. Darwin's evolution theory, nowadays widely accepted as knowledge of natural history, is thus inextricably intertwined with its mode or format of representation. So what we can access is not pure knowledge, but knowledge always already connected to certain formats, structures, genres, and practices. To make this point a bit even clearer, I'd like to quote from Ralph Klausnitzer, and this is my translation of his quote. He says, knowledge only abounds in the inextricable connection of content and form. It is thus always bound to specific practices and formats of its constitution, material storage, and medially conditioned dissemination. Moreover, as especially the field of narrative psychology has shown in recent years, genres are also important in shaping and reconstructing life experience. As Jerome Bruner famously puts it, quote, we organize our experience and our memory of human happenings mainly in the form of narrative, unquote. Narrative forms and genres help or more fundamentally allow us to symbolically express, organize, and interpret our everyday experience. These generic forms are always culturally informed, that is, they carry a number of cultural norms and collective ideas with them. In this sense, the short story would be a cultural mode of making sense of the world, or a way of world-making, as Ansgar Nuning has called it. So rather that than a mere literary genre. And maybe this is also what Susan Lohhafer, a renowned short story scholar, has in mind when she speaks of the short storiness in the world, and I quote her briefly. She says, it is impossible to define the short story genre. One can, however, describe, deploy, and evaluate a variety of frames that allow us to know and respond to short storiness in the world, unquote. Thus, when we engage with genres as culturally specific patterns of meaning production, we not only gain insights into literary conventions, but also into standardized forms of meaning production, or knowledge production, that is. So this would be the third point on the slide that you see, the role of genre in shaping and constructing or reconstructing life experiences. Now, what does that all mean for the genre of the short story and its relation to life knowledge? Firstly, and very basically, and I have to skip, I think, one or two slides here. Firstly, and very basically, it means that the knowledge of the short story can hardly be separated from its specific form and structure. The short story isn't merely a container for a certain knowledge. It doesn't just wrap up this knowledge, which then can be unwrapped and isolated by the reader. In fact, we could even assume that the short story is itself a form of knowledge. As a cultural artifact, it provides the form for expressing certain particularities, and through this interrelation between form and content becomes cultural knowledge itself. If we want to address the question of what characterizes the knowledge of the short story, thus we have to keep this basic assumption in mind. Genre and knowledge become, in a way, inseparable, as only the particular form allows a particular knowledge to be expressed. Secondly, in the dynamic relationship of authors, texts, readers, specific historical and cultural situation, and now this should remind you of the slide of the communication model, where you have all these elements like in this model. In their relation, the genre short story, as all other genres, is constantly renewed, reactualized, and modified. A set of conventions and practices, it is an ever-changing abstraction. Abstraction means it doesn't exist in a pure form, but only as an abstraction. Thus, we can only approximate, but never actually and finally grasp the genre as a whole. Thirdly, literature is such a highly abstract term, even more abstract than short story, as you can imagine, which only becomes manifest in particular forms, and the short story must be understood as one such specific form of literature. Literature, just like knowledge, doesn't exist in a pure abstraction, but only in concrete actualizations. This might sound rather trivial for all of you by now already know, of course, and might have even known before you began your studies that there are different literary genres. So even though it might sound rather trivial, it has far-reaching consequences in our case. If we regard the short story as an actualization or manifestation of literature, the short story becomes an object of inquiry that cannot tell us something about itself, but also about literature in general. With Otmar Etter, we can conceive of short stories as condensed literary forms. Through the analysis of short stories, we might be able to examine phenomena, strategies, and forms that are typical of literature in general. And from this perspective, the knowledge of the short story might not be neatly separable from the knowledge of other literary forms, such as, for instance, the novel, but rather exemplary of these forms. Hence, and this is maybe the most important point, we don't claim that the short story knows more or something essentially different about life than other literary forms. However, since the knowledge of literature is always comes in concrete manifestations, we have to take the specific forms and genres into account. And it's important to know the balancing act here. In order to explore the knowledge of the short story, we must keep in mind that it is not essentially, in essence, different from other literary genres, but that via generic conventions, the forms of the short story or the form of the short story preconditions and constitutes its specific knowledge. To sum this up again, and again very briefly, what is most important for our purposes today? When I speak of the short story as a genre of life knowledge, I don't assume any kind of essentialist notion of what that text type might be, but instead regard it as a set of textual tendencies and practices. And wherever we might locate this presence on the level of the text, on an intertextual level, that is, in the relationship between different texts, a group of texts, on the level of the authors and readers' knowledge, and so on. I am not so much interested in warming up the tedious discussion of what is or what is not characteristic of the short story on a purely textual basis. From a very practical starting point, I am, at least for the moment, content with the assertion that the generic marker short story is successful in regulating literary communication in the described way. So far, I have used the term knowledge and knowledge of literature, and this brings us to the next point. So far, I have used the term knowledge and knowledge of literature or knowledge of the short story without explaining what this knowledge is. In what follows, I'll therefore limit the term life knowledge to the realm of the human condition, or conditio humana. In German, it would translate something like allgemeinmenschliches Wissen. And this particular kind of knowledge, although it is often disregarded as metaphysical mist or a triviality, is, as philosophers and psychologists have been convincingly arguing, there are good reasons, even from the point of view of science or Wissenschaft, why we shouldn't dismiss this knowledge all too easily. In contrast to other institutions concerned with knowledge, the sciences, for example, or philosophy, literature has the privilege to express principles of human life that would not withstand the exact categories and parameters of the life sciences, but which nevertheless fulfill important functions in the realm of culture or society, as well as in the lives of individual human beings. As Tilman Köppe points out in his recent study, Literatur und Erkenntnis, Literature and Cognition, and I quote from him, again, this is my translation, "General expressions of the human conditions don't have their place in science, where exactness is required, but they serve the theoretical and practical orientation in daily routine. When people need to comprehend their own behavior or the behavior of others or to determine future options, rough patterns for orientation are often more useful than precise rules or strategies. As often as not, due to the lack of time and resources, everyday situations don't allow for an evaluation of a precise rule or a complex strategy." This is, at least today, what I refer to as the life knowledge or the, of literature or the short story, a tacit knowledge about human principles, about conditio humana, about allgemeinmenschliches. Now, taking all these considerations into account, the term repository that you find on the slide might be a bit misleading. Repository meaning something like Speicher or Behälter, and I've just argued that it doesn't simply act as a repository. We can put some knowledge inside and then take it out again. So even though it might be a bit misleading, I use the term here and right now simply for the lack of a better alternative up to date. So all suggestions for a better alternative would be very welcome. Now, how does the short story link to the realm of the conditio humana, the human condition? The idea that the short story is a particularly well-equipped medium for expression and reflection of human life is not new. The close connection between the short story and life has been pointed out repeatedly and extensively, even so much so that it can be regarded as a commonplace in literary criticism and literary studies. According to this position, short stories are closely connected to life insofar as they portray life's fragmentary and flesh-like quality. In the Cambridge Introduction to the American Short Story, for instance, Martin Scofield writes in 2006, There is a sense in which the forum does lend itself to the examination of scenes from the life of the common man or woman, episodes and crises which are typical of those of ordinary life, but hardly demand the developed treatment of the novel, unquote. And whereas this examination of scenes from the everyday life of everyday people can be traced back to the old roots and early literary predecessors of the short story, such as Boccaccio's Decameron or Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, it becomes a kind of trademark of the genre with the rise of literary modernism. The short story, due to its relative brevity, was not only a preferred genre for formal and thematic experiments, which then could be applied to longer forms and especially to the novel. From an aesthetic point of view, the genre was also perfectly equipped to respond to and bring about the developments and upheavals in society and the history of mentalities that characterized the late 19th and early 20th century. And this, again, very much in the sense of Ricoeur's threefold model of mimesis that has been introduced to you by Anske Nunning. The witness fragmentariness and restlessness of modern life, for instance, were among the aspects connected to the aesthetics of the short story. When it repeatedly encounters the idea that the short story is somehow up to speed with the realities of modern life. In a very similar vein, Charles May notes, and I quote from him, "The form is best able to convey the sense that reality itself is fragmentary and inconclusive. Such a view should be especially pertinent to the modern world." So closely connected to the modernist conception of the short story is the idea that the genre provides something like a flash of insight or a glimpse through that all of a sudden reveals the secrets of life to characters and readers. Short stories often deal with significant moments in the life of a character, moments which cannot be easily integrated in a plain, linear, or teleological life narrative of a novel or a biography or autobiography, but nevertheless carry or epitomize something like the meaning of life, if we might want to call it that. With this emphasis on the significant moment, the short story questions the possibility of a causally ordered, coherent life narrative and instead stresses the symbolic moments which come to typify a life. And this is again a quote from the book by Martin Scofield. John Bailey's quote is another position that is quite representative for this. And when he says, and I quote, "The short story effect, if we can agree to call it that, the short story effect, the epiphany or spot of time may be met with everywhere and in almost every genre, poems, novels, nouvelles, though the short story itself, of course, affords it complete and conscious existence. For Bailey and others, the short story is a vehicle for the sense of life's unfulfillment, the momentariness of its experience." Other inquiries largely resemble this assumption. I don't have the time to go into detail here. Just maybe one more position or one more quote that buttresses or corroborates this point of view. Again, Charles May, one of the most renowned scholars in the short story, holds that the genre focuses on a moment of time that meaningfully breaks up the routine of everyday life, and he avers that the short story can yield us some single bizarre occurrence or epiphany and terror. For May, the short story is particularly apt to reflect human reality in moments that cannot be so easily naturalized. So this is more or less the main field of knowledge about human condition that I'm tracing or taking from short story theory and short story criticism, and now try to see how this connects to our larger topic of the life knowledge of literature. Now, let's turn to one particular short story serving as an example of how the genre can be regarded as a genre of life knowledge. First, let me give you some very brief information about its author, Alice Munro, since Munro might not be as well known as, for instance, Shakespeare that we heard about last week. So Alice Munro is a Canadian writer. She was born in 1931. You can see all this information from the slide. I don't have to go through that in detail. She began writing, or rather publishing, short stories in the late 60s and soon earned critical praise. Today, Munro is acknowledged worldwide as one of the most versatile, sophisticated, and original practitioners of the short story. In fact, she hardly writes anything but short stories, so that makes her an extremely good example for our purposes here. She's widely acclaimed in academia, her work being the subject of numerous studies, and this year, only in 2009, she has been awarded the Man Booker International Prize, quite prestigious prize for her life's work. So that shows a bit of her prestige and position in the academic world and as a writer of short stories. Her stories are mostly set in her home area of rural Ontario and thus have a very strong regional focus. In this regard, she can be placed in a long tradition of other so-called regional writers, and especially of short stories, people like William Faulkner, Eudora Welty, Flannery O'Connor, so on and so forth. Munro's short story that I want to talk about today, in maybe 7 to 8 minutes, What Do You Want to Know For?, was first published in 2006 in her collection, The View from Castle Rock. It tells the story of a nameless 60-odd-year-old woman, she's also the first-person narrator, facing a life crisis after getting a frightening medical diagnosis. In a routine examination, a lump is found in her breast, about the size of a pea. Strangely enough, the narrator immediately relates this medical detail to a seemingly meaningless episode from a life that had happened 1 year before. On a trip to the rural areas of southern Ontario, she and her husband had come across a large, unnatural-looking mound that, at a closer look, turned out to be a crypt. No clues to who or what might be hidden inside. For about 1 year, she had forgotten about this crypt, but all of a sudden, she feels a strong need to see it again and I quote from her, or from the narrator, find out something about it, unquote. However, when she and her husband set off to revisit the crypt, they can't find it immediately. Quote, we spent 3 or 4 afternoons looking for it, and we were puzzled and disconcerted. But it was a pleasure, as always, to be together in this part of the world, looking at the countryside that we think we know so well, and that is always springing some sort of surprise on us, unquote. Already making the connection between the unknown parts of the land and the unknown parts of the human body, the country and the body are both able to spring their surprises on the narrator. This extended trip to the country turns out into a quest for knowledge. Exploring the countryside, the narrator seeks to find distraction from the threat of her next medical examination. But it is more than just killing time. Geographical and historical details catch her interest, and one after another, she unfolds a number of secrets hidden in this part of the land. The landscape itself reveals its own geological knowledge, all documented in a special map and a book called The Physiography of Southern Ontario. And I looked it up and found this picture, which is taken from this map. So the map actually exists in reality, a map that maps some kind of special geographical, geological knowledge. At the cemetery where the mysterious crypt is located, the names of the deceased are nearly all German, testifying to the forgotten chapters of German-Canadian colonial history. More and more curious, the narrator visits local towns and college libraries and interviews people in the villages to find out more about the history of the crypt, which nobody else, except her, of course, seems to be interested in. Quite to her surprise, the stories she encounters even link up to her own family history. She meets people who knew and remember her parents and finds comfort and hope in this. In the fearfully expected examination, finally, it is found that the lump had been in her breast for years without changing its shape or size significantly. Thus relieved, the narrator moves on to her daily routines, not without noticing that these will probably never be exactly the same after this episode of her life. As the title of the story already indicates, knowledge is a very odd thing in this story. The clinical knowledge provided by the life sciences, that is, the narrator's cancer diagnosis, may be crucial for follow-up medical care and therefore for saving her life. But it also discloses a void of a different kind of knowledge, a knowledge that can hardly be provided by special disciplines, be it radiology, historiography, or geography. In Monroe's story, the event of the upcoming biopsy, or the examination preceding this biopsy, causes the protagonist to question and re-examine, re-evaluate, and quite literally remap her life knowledge. Not the technical knowledge of the life sciences, here provided in the form of medical diagnosis, provides her with what she needs in order to find orientation and comfort. Instead, a different and rather marginal, insignificant, and obscure knowledge becomes important. The links between the lump that was discovered in her breast, the geological details hiding beneath the visible surface of the landscape, the region's repressed colonial history, and her own family history abound mainly on a structural level. They all have to do with the acquisition and oblivion of a knowledge that is not immediately accessible. The knowledge in, or rather of, the story, however, resides in the making of these connections. We might refer to it as a reintegrative interdiscourse, kind of making connections between all these specialized discourses such as geography, radiology or medicine, and history. And even more importantly, in being aware of the tentativeness of such a knowledge. Just as the landscape and the history of the region are always in motion, always in transition, the body is also subject to constant transformation. And as the narrator remarks at one point in the story, so you have to keep checking, taking in the changes, seeing things while they last. Now, witnessing that time is running out faster than I had hoped for, I might just skip some aspects and come to my conclusion, or the conclusion of my short analysis of the story. So far, I've been merely discussing Monroe's story as a single text, more or less disregarding its generic classification as short story. The question, of course, would be in how far is the story typical of the genre, especially as far as its relation to life and life knowledge is concerned. Now, Monroe uses the form of the short story to express an alternative life knowledge that cannot be reduced to bodily functions and biochemical processes or compartmentalized in the domains of history, of geography. What Do You Want to Know For is a typical short story in as much as it deals with a crisis or turning point in the life of its protagonist. In the story, to use a definition of the genre by Charles May again, an experience is lifted out of the everyday flow of human actuality and active striving, an experience that is lifted out precisely because it is not a slice of that reality, but rather a moment in which reality itself is challenged, or the knowledge of reality, we might add, unquote. Monroe's, by stressing the momentariness of experience, Monroe's story reflects human reality in moments that cannot be so easily naturalized. So although knowledge is such a relative and unstable category in the story, What Do You Want to Know For almost paradoxically unfolds and makes accessible a certain kind of knowledge, life knowledge, to the reader. And this is supported by the afterword of David Leavitt in the O. Henry Prize stories from 2008, in which Monroe's story appeared as well. And there, the American writer David Leavitt comments on that story and expresses that in the course of reading the story, he says, I had learned a great deal, not only about the cemeteries of Western Ontario, but about, there is no better way to say this, how to live, unquote. So Leavitt's quote reiterates the view that short stories can reveal to their readers the essence of a life and serving as a medium of life knowledge. Now, to make this point clear, the observation that literature and the short story can have effects on understanding of life and on how people live surely cannot be the final word of literary studies as life science. Quite to the contrary, such an approach has to find, or would have to find, methods to prove or corroborate this contention. It is exactly this point, of course, that constitutes the main research desideratum today, including all of the diverse factors and dimensions that we have been touching upon in our lecture today, ranging from textual and generic conventions through cognitive processes, through culturally and historical specific formats and discourses of knowledge. So we have another 3 minutes to end of our...
I think this guy deserves applause. Thanks very much. I'll just wind it up very quickly. Please bear with us for another 2 minutes. So, first question is, why would we want to do that sort of thing? And second question is, what can you actually do? Which slide do we have now? That slide, okay. First of all, let's look at the reasons why such a project is so very interesting. And the reason can be summed up in the quotations by Rüsen and Sternberg. I think all of us, this is you and you and you and we should really try to bend over backwards to tell the public at large that what we are doing is relevant, that it's politically relevant, that it's culturally relevant. And look at the quotation by Rüsen, and this will tell you why. The future of the humanities, and this is, I think, what is at stake, not just in the strike out there, but even more so in here, the future of the humanities depends on their capabilities to produce the kind of knowledge that is needed in order to orientate oneself within the meaning dimensions, Sinndimensionen, of human life, and to stand in for the kind of education building needed for a competent way of living. And I think this is exactly what the project of literary studies as a kind of life science could do. If you want to be a little bit more specific and ask yourself, well, when I write a BA or MA thesis, I will be unlikely to write about life knowledge as such in the abstract. So our suggestion would be to look at topics like this. Focus, perhaps, on what does literature, and literature always stands for the works of a particular author in a particular period, a particular genre, you just name it, whatever you do in a particular seminar. What does literature know about, for instance, and this is a list of topics that Michael Busler and I would like to suggest would be of particular interest for you for BA and MA thesis or Seminararbeiten, consciousness and the unconscious. What does literature know about perception, cognition, emotion? Our thesis is literature is a privileged medium for gaining knowledge about perception, cognition, emotion. The same holds true about memory and forgetting. Read Michael Busler's dissertation, an excellent book, if you have any doubts. Other aspects, what does literature know about friendship and love? These are very, very interesting and important topics. What does literature know about forms of communication and distortions in communication, Kommunikationsstörung? What does literature know about individual and collective crises? Michael just mentioned turning points. If I had to write a dissertation tomorrow, I'd probably write on turning points. And I think the short story is a privileged medium for exploring turning points. When a life suddenly changes, read Paul Auster if you have any doubts. What does literature know about historical models of crises? And last but not least, what does literature know about transnational media events? What we sincerely hope is that some of you will take up these suggestions, and if you need help, everything you've always wanted to know about new theories, models, and methods in literary and cultural studies, but were afraid to ask, you'll find the answers in Metzler Lexikon Literatur und Kulturtheorie, vierte Auflage, in Zeiten, wo selbst dritt-, viert- und fünftklassige Sendungen im Fernsehen von Werbepausen unterbrochen werden, dürfen Vorträge in Ringvorlesungen über deren dritt-, viert- oder fünftklassigkeit, Herr Basler und ich das Urteil Ihnen überlassen, keine Ausnahme machen. Haben Sie herzlichen Dank.